divide the talk into two parts. In the first part, I'm going to sort of give an overview of what it means to be talk about cognition at all, and explain just one particular way of looking at cognition that comes out of the work of a famous cognitive scientist, David Marr, and just explain how you think about the mind and how you think about processing in the mind. The second part, I'm going to do something like Wikipedia almost, a few short examples of the big themes that people study in cognition, with sort of some fun examples, fun for me. Okay, so let me start with what cognition is. So cognitive science really is the scientific study of the mind, in the most general sense. So the big question, of course, is what is the mind, right? What we can see is we can see the brain, we can see behavior, we can see ion channels of various sorts, we can see people smiling, and somehow we have to induce that from all of this material mass emerges something like the mind. So in some sense, it is really thought to be an emergent property, like what Vidya was talking about yesterday. Now it's important to realize that it wasn't always the case that everyone thought that the mind emerged from, you know, the physical body. In fact, the classical position by Descartes was that the mind and body were two separate kinds of things. So the body was made up of different kinds of stuff than the mind was made up of, and the mind was somehow secreted from the body. But of course, the modern analysis, if you want, of cognition and of the mind, is that the mind is somehow an emergent property of the rest of the body, in particular the brain. Okay, so how do we really think about the mind in cognitive science? And really, this notion has been greatly influenced by computer science. And the analogy is the mind as an information processing device, but without making any substantive claims about what information is and about what processing is. Okay, so you can have your pet theories of information, your pet theories of processing, and really what we talk about in cognition is how does the mind process information? And so the first thing I want to do is to try to kind of flesh out this notion of information processing and what it might mean. Now you have to understand that even if you take the computer science analogy, it might not even be the appropriate analogy, right? So we know that there are certain kinds of things that computers are not capable of doing. It's not clear if the mind is or is not capable of those limitations that computers have. So we don't even know if this analogy of the mind as a computer is a good enough analogy. So I want to stay with the more general sense of an information processing device. So, how does something process information? Now the idea is that information is presented or gotten in some format, and then you transform this format in various ways, hopefully to do something useful. And sort of helps me to do analogies for everything, like the computer analogy. My analogy for information processing is a meat grinder. So the idea is that you have little chunks of meat, which is your input, and then you turn the handle and you make minced meat. So this is essentially the notion of information processing. Information is the little chunks of meat, and the processing, you convert it into some other form, in this case, minced meat. Now, let me talk about format a little bit. Now, you can't take a cow and put it in the mincer, right? I mean, if I take a cow, it doesn't work with the mincer. It's not because it cannot in theory do it, it's just, it's the wrong format. That's not the kind of thing that the meat processor is built to accept, right? So that's not the right format. Now similarly, what about beer? If I pour beer into the meat grinder, it's the same thing, it's just going to flow right through. I can turn the handle all I want, I'm not going to change the input in any way. Okay? So sort of the important point from this, which is obvious for people from computer science, of course, is that representations matter. Okay? So the kind of representations that you have are going to be important for the kind of information processing machine that you have. So the first thing I want to do now is to talk about representations and computation and what this means. So here's somebody thinking about saving up money to buy an iPad 3. Okay? And the idea is that what's happening is inside her mind, there is something that stands for the iPad 3, and there's something that stands for money. Okay, so there's some relation between something in the mind. Don't worry about what is it. Is it a neuron? Is it a... It doesn't matter what it is. Can you hear me at the back?
Yes.
Okay. So,
Sorry, just to be clear. As you begin with mind information processing, then you are not making any difference between, for example, humans, dogs, or bacteria.
Yeah.
But when you are speaking about representations,
yes.
I have a problem with bacteria. What do you mean if you are thinking in terms of bacteria?
Look, for me, it's an empirical issue. If you can show that bacteria can perform the same kind of mental computation or find evidence that you can explain their behavior as some kind of a mental computation, then you have to say that they have the same kind of representation. And you have to bother separately about how that representation is actually embodied. And I'll come to this point later. But for now, I'm agnostic. Okay? If I can make the claim, if I can show that a person can think about iPad 3s and buying iPad 3s, if I have any evidence for this, then I'm saying that there must be something in the mind that has these two representations and some process that can put these two representations together to compute the thought that I want to buy an iPad 3 and I have to save money to do so. Is that clear? So if a bacteria can, if you can show a bacteria can have that thought, I'm willing to ascribe it the same kinds of, or at least similar kinds of representations. So that's what a representation really is. And this has been called the classical view for various reasons. A representation is just something that stands for something else. Okay, in computers, it's of course obvious. Like when we think, when we are trying to model the climate, we don't actually have the climate in our computers. We have things that stand for, like the wind, the temperature, and so forth. And we carry out little computations that we think mimic the processes that actually happen out there. Right? So in that sense, it's also a symbolic system. Yes?
One quick one. It could be a big bottle of steel choice also. It need not be also in mind.
Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, would the mind be having just one choice?
No. So the general notion is that for any thought, let's say the thought was not that I want to buy an iPad, I want to steal an iPad.
Right.
In that case too, there is something in your mind that is the concept, steal.
Choice, if I can borrow it, I may not steal an iPad.
True, but see, in every single case, in any thought that you have, right, you can decompose the thought. So I can say the thought or the fact, suppose I want to make a choice. Let's say I'm at the stage of saying, I have to make a choice whether I should buy an iPad or steal an iPad, right? That thought that I have, that I have the thought that I have a choice between buying and stealing, that's just a very complex thought. And that very complex thought is made up of thoughts like iPad, money, buy, steal, want, and so forth. So the idea is that there are these thoughts, and these thoughts combine to give more complex thoughts. And a representation simply is a thought that stands for something out there. And something out there could be an iPad, it could be money. It could be the notion of beauty. It could be anything. So that's the notion, the idea of a representation. So in that sense, it's symbolic. And what do I mean by symbolic? Is that you sort of propose that there is something like a little symbol in your mind that stands for something out there. Okay, so there is something like a little icon of an iPad in your mind that stands for an actual iPad. And when I'm thinking about iPads, this little icon in my mind is taking part in those computations. Does that make sense? So, symbols are thought to have something called, technically it's called intentionality. What it really means is that they have aboutness. They're about something. So a symbol in my mind is about something out there. That's sort of the notion. Sort of the more, if you want, modern counterpoint to this is called a connectionist view. And the idea there is that in representations, you do not have these symbols. There are no symbols in your mind. In fact, when you try to, if you have ever opened up a brain and seen inside, you don't really see symbols like you see in, I don't know where you see symbols. So there are no symbols, but what you have is that concepts, things like iPads or buying or stealing, are represented in a, some sort of a distributed manner. Okay, so you have a network, for example, like a neural network, and there's some state of the neural network that stands for an iPad, and there's some other state that stands for stealing, for example. Okay, so this is sort of the counterpoint, that you don't have a symbolic system in your mind. What you have is these distributed representations. And I want to come to this sort of divide, because this is a big divide in the field. And I want to come to a way of trying to think about this divide.
The symbol is in a format which we can see, but this is not in a format which we can recognize as a symbol. Actually, all these are symbols.
Exactly. So, yeah. Right. And I want to just flesh out that particular point in this first part. Okay, computations. This is really the information modifying processes, and I don't have much to say about computation, except that they are roughly sometimes classified by the type of operation. So, for example, sorting or storing in memory, and the input that you operate over. Okay, and I just put a reference to Jacques von Helen's talk because I think what he's going to talk about is how there are these certain motifs in networks, and the motifs seem to be of the sort that carry out a certain computation. Now, if that motif occurs in a network of gene regulation, then it carries out that kind of an operation for gene regulation. If it happens in the neural network for language, then it does that sort of computation for language. Okay, so there's a distinction between the operation itself and the kind of input that the operation is performed over. Now, already this should tell you that there are different ways of thinking about, there should be different levels. There should be a notion of talking about what the computation itself is and where the computation is applied. Okay? And here I want to come to this tri-level hypothesis that David Marr, a vision scientist, proposed for vision. But I think it's applicable not just for cognition, but also for understanding some of the themes that we have been talking about. And here's sort of the general layout that Marr proposed. The first level was something he called computational. Now this level, the name is a little bit misleading. What the level is really about is it's some sort of like the task level. That what's the task and why is this task important? Okay. Now this is very similar to the questions you ask in evolution. So for example, you might ask that what's the function of wings? What's the task that what is it that they're trying to solve? What is an animal trying to solve when it evolves wings? And I don't mean this in the that you evolve. Okay, directed way, but you know, when there's an evolution of wings, what's the function? That's the kind of question you're asking. At the algorithmic level, essentially you're asking what kind of program can do that task solving, and finally at the implementational level, you can ask what's the hardware that can implement algorithms that can solve the task. So I just want to go through these levels using another analogy, but this one taken from Marr himself, and that of a cash register. Okay, so computational task level. What does it do and why? Well, what it does is it adds money, dollars and rupee paise amounts, right? Why does it do it? Well, because the principles of mathematics make sense for buying goods at a supermarket. Why? Well, if you buy an apple and nothing else, that's A plus 0 is A, you have an identity element. If you buy an apple and a banana, it doesn't matter what order you buy the apple and banana, that's something like the commutative property in mathematics. You have something like the distributive property. If I first buy an apple and then I realize, oh, I also have to buy a banana and a cucumber, or first I buy an apple and a banana and afterwards I say, oh, I also need to add a cucumber, it won't matter what the final amount is, right? So the properties of mathematics, like the identity element, commutativity, distributivity, these are all the kinds of things that make sense when you want to add dollar cent amount. Okay, that's why you want to, the task is that you want to add these amounts, and why? Because that's what makes sense for this particular task. Algorithmic. What program or recipe can you use to achieve this? So this is sort of the standard thing that we learn, right? You put the numbers in columns, and then you line the columns up from right to left, and then you add them up, you carry over, and so forth. Right? This is the standard adding algorithm we all know. Now, of course, it's not the only algorithm. So some of you might know there's another way of adding these numbers is starting from the leftmost column first and keep adding rows for each place and then add up those rows. Okay, so you don't have to start from the right, you can start from the left. There can be different algorithms. But now, here's the problem. If you're Romans, this algorithm won't work at all. I mean, that's complete gibberish. Like adding the Roman numbers, it just doesn't make any sense because they don't have this notion of, you know, units, tens, hundreds, places, right? And in fact, if you want to do addition in Roman, there's this other kind of algorithm, which is, it's complex. So what's the point of this? The point of this is that the precise algorithm depends on your choice of representation. Okay? If you think you want to build a program that can do addition using those column methods, you better be using the Arabic system. If you're using the Roman system, that's not going to work. But it's just going to give you some crazy answers, right?
Implementational.
Now, implementational simply means how do I make a machine that can carry out these algorithms, right? So here's the modern cash register made of plastic and silicon. This is the supposedly the world's first cash register, James Lee's incorruptible cashier. This is an abacus made entirely of wood. So the idea is that if I just look at the material that this is made of, that's not going to tell me much about the function. I have to actually look at what the thing is doing. So that's why sometimes this is called functionalism, that you look at the function rather than the material that the stuff is made of. Okay? And the idea is that you can implement a single algorithm using a variety of different hardware, if you want. Okay? So this is sort of the computation I just switched over to task, just for ease of understanding. So for a given task, you have to choose some representation. Given that representation, there are various algorithms that you can use, and finally you have to have some means of implementing those algorithms. Now why did I go through these levels in such detail? Well, because at least to me, it helps me think about, in general, about really everything. And let me just give the example of, well, thoughts, right? What is thinking? What is the purpose of thinking? How does thinking happen? This would be, if you want, a task level description of anything you're interested in, whether it is language, whether it is vision. At the algorithmic level, you can ask both what are the sort of representations that we might have and what are the sort of processes that we might have to put together the representation such that we can explain what's happening at the task level. Okay, so in terms of language, you can ask that what might be the kinds of representations that you need to invoke in order that you can use some processes to explain speech. Okay, or to explain vision. And at the implementational level, finally you can ask, like, how do you implement these various theories that you have made up, right? You came up with some representation, and now how can you implement these representations? And the reason I think this is a useful way of thinking is because very often, when somebody talks about neural networks, you can think of it as an implementational level rather than as the computational or the task level. And I think this helps to organize various different fields. Like if somebody is working in neural networks, for example, then the kinds of algorithms or the kinds of processes that they have, in some sense, have to line up with what you observe at a behavioral level. On the other hand, at the behavioral level, things that you see must somehow make contact with the neural level, or how you think the neural level might instantiate various algorithms and representations. So only by working kind of bottom-up and top-down simultaneously, I think you can really make sense of something as complex as cognition. But the point is that it's not true just of cognition, right? Because in one of the examples from a previous talk, from Paul's talk, when Paul was talking about the mechanisms like slippage, etc., that was, if you want, algorithmic implementation level, but at the task level, what was happening was that the mutation rates were changing. Or rather, there was a polymorphism at the phenotypic level, right? So at the top level, you can describe the process as phenotypic polymorphism,
plasticity.
But at the more molecular level, at the implementational level, you can explain it as things like DNA polymerase slippage and so forth. Okay, so it helps you relate levels across. It helps you relate across levels. Okay, so that is the first part about how you just think about cognition in general. And the second part, I want to talk about some of the big themes that people think about in cognition. So these are sort of the big picture things people think about. Perception, attention, memory, something called executive functions, which I'll explain in a second, and language. In general, language is so important for humans, and it's such a good sort of entry point to asking things about the human mind that it's considered a whole separate part of cognition. But of course, everything is closely related to each other. Now, usually people study all of these processes both at the behavioral level. So, you know, what's happening? Just describing the system in the first place, and then also looking at how does the brain support all these sorts of behaviors. I'll actually just be showing you the behavioral part and ignoring the brain almost entirely. Okay, so perception. So this is really how the senses work. That kind of the broad idea of perception. One of the things I want to sort of emphasize is that the senses are actually quite impoverished. So if I think about standing in front of you and if I ask how many bits of information, visual information, is out there in front of me, I don't even know how I could compute this number. But what you can do is at the retinal level, you can ask how many cells are there in the retina, and you can, you know, making some approximations, assumptions, come up with a number of about 10 to the 9 bits. So assuming that every single retinal cell is either in an on or an off state. When you go to the optic nerve, that is the nerve that goes from the retina back to the rest of the brain, you find that that number goes down to 10 to the 7. So there's a 2 orders of magnitude reduction in the data going from the eye to the brain. Eye is part of the brain, but from the eye to the rest of the brain.
And human system is not necessarily binary.
No, but it's not. It's an approximation. So just to give an idea of what kind of numbers we are dealing with. But then, when you come to visual attention, so if you think about it for a moment, then it's not like the entire room is in focus every single moment. You're moving your eyes about, picking out individual people, objects, locations around you, right? So visual attention is just about how much information you are paying attention to at that instant. And that seems to be really low, of the order of 40 bits. And I'll give you an example of this in a little bit. But the main point is this. Yes?
That seems to be
sufficient. The question is why? Why is it that when you go from 10 to the 9 to 40, you think it's sufficient, right? And the sort of the answer is that, okay, to tell you the answer, sort of, I'm going to give another analogy. I love analogies because it just helps. It helps me think, and I hope it helps you think as well. Now, this is an analogy from one of the other senses. Now, those of you who know algorithm and know the sense. So, imagine that there's a big lake. Okay. Now, I go to the corner of the lake and I draw two little channels. Okay. So the water sort of comes into the channel. There's a little bit of water in the two channels. This big lake in front of me. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to ignore the rest of the lake and just look at these two little channels in front of me. Now the lake is filled with things, motorboats and whales and all kinds of things. Now my task is to look at just these two little channels and try to figure out how many objects there are, what they are, how large, where are they moving, everything just by looking at these two little channels. Now that's exactly what audition is. If you close your eyes, you just have these two little channels that are part of this big lake of sound in front of you, and all the noises that are coming, if you go to an opera and sit back and you close your eyes, you can tell there's an opera singer over there, there's a little, there are pipes over there, there's a guitar down there, there's a big body falling down, probably the opera singer. You can tell these things, right? You can tell it just by looking at the little vibrations that come into your ears. That's the amount of information that comes into your senses and the amount that you're sort of recreating in the world in front of you. And so the notion is now that perception really is a form of reconstruction. And it's a form of inference. So what you're trying to do is that you're not trying to really see everything out there or listen to everything, but you're trying to reconstruct what might be out there using very sophisticated models in your mind. Okay, and this is sort of the modern view of perception. Another sort of important idea in perception is this idea of divide and conquer. So the idea about divide is that different modalities, as you know, are, you know, computed separately. You have the visual cortex, you have the auditory cortex, and so forth. So it turns out now, of course, that these cortices, which are thought to be entirely devoted to a single sense, actually do have crosstalk between them. Again, you can ask me about that. It's really fascinating. But even within a modality, you have different processing of different aspects. So here's an example. There's a bottle in front of me. Now you might think that the color, the shape, the location of the bottle, it's just kind of one unitary whole for you, perceptually, right? You perceive it very holistically. It turns out that the identity of the bottle, the fact that it's a bottle, is computed sort of in the ventral part of the brain. And the fact that it is over there and that I need to reach out and grab it like this, is computed in a different area of the brain, in the dorsal part. So much so that you can find patients some of whom can look at the object and tell you what it is, but when they go to pick it up, they might do something like that, which is just wrong, right? So they have no idea how to actually go, where to go, and how to grab the object, but they know it perfectly well that it's a bottle. On the other hand, there are people with damage to the ventral parts who can reach the, and grab the bottle perfectly well, but have no idea that it's a bottle. So you have completely separate processing of the identity of an object and the location, the spatial location and the kind of how do you reach out and grab the object computation. These are separate, right? And the concur part is that we put all of these things together. So we divide up the world, we look at the different aspects of the world, but then we put it all back together and we have this sense that it's this holistic view of the world around us, right? So here's one of the examples of this concur part of putting things together. What you can do is you can show people little blinks of light coming up at regular intervals. Let's say every 2 seconds, it's a blink, 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 blink. Now at the same time, you also play a little beep, 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 beep. It turns out that if the beep is slightly misaligned with the flag, you perceive it as if they're completely aligned. So it's as if the mind is thinking, you know, there's this beep and there's this flash and they sort of seem to be happening at roughly the same time. Maybe they are happening at the same time. So let us both agree, let the visual sense and the auditory sense agree and say that yes, it's happening at the exactly the same time. So we sort of fix little defects in the world around us. Now this is particularly clear in language. In language you can delete just chunks of information and you still hear speech perfectly well. In fact, the big problem with speech recognition is the fact that when you add noise to speech, it gets really hard for computers, at least now, to be able to recover the underlying speech. And the reason is because we seem to have this amazing way of trying to figure out what things might be, not what things are really out there. Attention. So attention is kind of a little bit fuzzy. It's sort of concentrated mental activity. It's like if I tell you look at that bottle and you're looking at it and trying to figure things out about that bottle. It's essentially concentrated mental activity. It can be directed at various areas, various locations, various objects. So an example is that in this talk, you know, there might be other noise sources like the humming of that, or there are other visual objects, locations around you that you might not be looking at. You might not be looking at the top right corner of the hall, for example. Okay, here's a really strange condition called hemispatial neglect, where you completely fail to pay attention to just one part of the space in front of you. So in this particular case of left hemispatial neglect, when you go out to shave, then you sort of, because you're completely neglecting one area of space, you only shave one half of your face. Very interesting aberration because of a lack of attention of the appropriate sort. Okay, remember how I said visual attention is really limited, that it's just about 40 bytes? So, okay, now here's a little demo for you. You're going to see an image and then it'll say pay attention again and then you'll see another image. How many people saw a change? Wow, none? Zero? One change? One change?
Could you play it again?
No. Let me go back and forth. Yes.
I saw a change.
You saw one change. Okay, awesome. So here's the original image. Let me go back and forth. So that's what I mean. You know, we really have very poor visual sense. It's not like we see the scene, we encode everything. In fact, what we do is we pick out little important bits and concentrate on those and just sort of ignore the rest. Who cares about the background, right? I mean, it's a street. We know what streets look like. One street looks like another street. You care that maybe there are two cars in the street. Probably that's what you really remember, right? If I took off a car, you'd really remember that. Memory. So the third major theme is essentially information retention over time. That's, you know, the big theme of memory. Again, just like vision or audition is not a single thing. Like you can break vision up into processing the location, the color, the identity and so forth. You can also sort of parcelate memory but in a different dimension. So there's sensory memory that's right at the senses. It's very brief. I'll tell you a little bit more about it in a second. Then there's something very interesting that's called working memory. So for example, you go and so for example, you look up a number in a phone book, 9823741, and then you go to the phone to actually call the number. Mentally, you're rehearsing that number. It's not that you remember that number, but you know that the moment you stop saying 9823461, it's just going to go off, right? So you're holding it for a short while in what's called a working memory. And working memory is really fascinating. It's got, so here's a really interesting fact about working memory. You can have a working memory for auditory objects and a working memory for spatial locations, and they're both completely distinct. Finally, you have long-term memory, which is, I think, the most familiar sort, which is the fact that you remember your birth date and you remember many facts for a fairly extended period of time. Okay, fun thing about memory. So I'm going to show you a grid, okay? And you just have to try to remember as many things as you can in the grid. It's a 3x3. Does somebody remember one?
G.
Okay. Do you remember, does somebody remember all the nine?
No.
Eight? Seven? Do you remember seven of them? Six objects? Six?
Three.
Four?
Four.
Five? Four? Three? Okay, so that's awesome because that's really what the capacity is like. It's something like 3 to 4 objects is what you can remember. Okay? Now this had been a kind of a cluster.
Grade
ourselves,
show the grade.
Oh, I'm so, okay. I think you just keep flashing up.
Okay.
Sorry. I'll get some chocolate. So here's what Sperling did in the 60s.
Is it related to the exposure time?
Yes, yes, it is. It is related to exposure time. Yeah. If I show you for a day, you know. So here's something that really interesting that Sperling did in the 60s. Here's how cued recall works. So it's the same sort of paradigm. I'll show you the numbers, and then immediately afterwards, it's replaced with a cue. So in this case, it's a visual cue. So you just have to report the central row, and not everything. Okay, so it's called partial report. And now here's the thing. If you remember roughly three objects, if I ask you to recall the middle row, on average you'd expect to remember one of the three, right? Instead, you remember all three. Now, people have shown this, you don't have to use visual cues, you can show auditory cues, so a low tone, a middle tone, a high tone. So you flash the grid and you play a high tone, you have to recall the topmost row. You show the grid and play a low tone, you have to recall the lowermost row. And people get all three every single time. Now this must mean that you actually store all nine elements in memory, because the location of this cue is at random, right? So this was evidence that, I forgot to say one thing. It completely depends on the offset between when the grid disappears and when this cue appears. If the cue appears early, then you remember everything. If the cue appears late, then you again remember maybe one object from that row. So what does this mean? That there is a very early storage that is really high capacity, like in this case 9 and not 3 that people had thought, right, for this grid. Now it turns out that when you show objects instead of these letters in a grid, this number goes down to 5. So you remember about 5 objects in this, it's called iconic memory. So it's a very brief store, but very rich store. And you sort of select things out of this store, you know, things that you remember. Now here's the cool thing. In the department that I'm at, people came up with this really beautiful way of doing this partial cue recall with 6-month-olds, and they showed that 6-month-olds have the same capacity as adults. Now, the notion of what memory capacities infants have has been a very contentious and long-standing issue. In fact, it's not even clear what kind of memory newborns have. Again, there are now experiments that show that they do have some sort of very interesting memory. So not only can they remember objects, or in this case, auditory objects, they can also remember some generalization over the objects. Executive functions. Now, executive functions is really kind of the higher level mental thinking, maybe you know, mathematics.
They are not really infants. That infants will record. They are not really infants. It's infancy as we see it. But actually, they have not died also. It's just the transfer of genes and going ahead. So, if you tell about the physiological age of that gene, it's unlimited.
That's true, but you know, I mean, there are differences. There are differences, and there are infant and ask it to run a marathon, it won't. Right?
And running is a different
I know. It's not, if you ask it to do maths, it won't. You have to ask it to do addition. Turns out this is not true. They can do addition, they can do certain pretty complex things. And you're right. There are some things that are encoded in the genes. It's just a matter that A, they're not easily visible. But if you can come up with the right experimental paradigm, you can actually show that infants are far richer in the terms of the capacities that they have than what had previously been thought. So you're right. We call them infants, but part of it is we don't understand them well enough. They're almost like a different species when we look at them. executive functions. Again, I'm just going to show this one little slide. It's really about things like, you know, if you want to buy a car, what do you do? So one of the new fields that's come out in this area is neuroeconomics. So how does the brain sort of process data? How does it make decisions? And then you, as an advertiser, how can you make use of how the brain makes decisions for you to make the kind of decisions that are good for my product? This is interesting. Okay, so it's really about planning, sequencing behaviors in various ways, using various schemas. And I don't want to go there. Social cognition. Now, I think this has sort of been fairly a newer part of cognition. Social cognition wasn't as, let's say, important when, you know, the whole cognitive revolution happened. The cognitive revolution in the 50s started with people like Chomsky and Skinner. Started off from, taking off from Skinner with Chomsky and people at MIT who did artificial intelligence and robotics. Really the focus started off from things like language and vision, which is why if you see the field is mostly dominated by people who work in language and vision. But now people have realized that every aspect of our mental life, including social transactions, are amenable to the same kinds of analyses that you use for language or vision, right? In social cognition, what sort of the idea is that you're trying to identify agents, ascribe them minds, and then try to deal with the consequences of agents having minds. So let me give you an example. Now this is from an experiment that has been done with fairly young infants, like under a year old. Now the question is, which object is more likely to fall down, right? And I think you should have the intuition it should be the red object on the right. Yeah. Now it turns out that infants have the same sort of intuition. Now you can see that what you're doing here is you're computing, if you want, physical properties of the objects. Now let me ask you a similar question. Which person is more likely to lie about her age? Right now, I mean, you could sort of, if you knew the people, make some guesses, but really, you know, why does she want to lie? Under what condition might she lie? What does she believe her true age to be? And so forth, right? Now the kind of terms I'm using are belief and want. Why does she want to lie? What does she believe her age to be? These are all mental terms. These are not terms that are directly visible in something out there. Something you ascribe to the person's mind. So this is sort of a key idea in social cognition, that you ascribe these mental terms. Now, to be honest,
So what you're calling intuition, is it some kind of your Chomsky universal language?
Good. Yeah, exactly. I'm going right there, in fact. That was my next sentence. So the next sentence was that this notion that you ascribe certain, let's say, hidden properties to the mind is exactly the same as in linguistics, right? In language, you ascribe that the person in their mind has things like nouns and verbs and certain rules of putting them together and certain reasons why they say certain words in certain conditions. Now, this is going to be kind of the focus of the next talk about how you can learn things using social cues, okay? But yeah, the idea is exactly that. If you ascribe certain more hidden properties to the mind of a person, and use them in sort of a predictive way. That's the important thing, that they have to be used in a predictive way. Now, there is this one sort of idea that has been really focal in all the talk about social cognition. It's the notion of theory of mind. And it's the idea that even infants, or even children, have the notion that somebody in front of them has a mind, and that person might believe something that might not be true. Right? So let me give you an example of a classic sort of study that has been used over and over again. It's called the Sally Ann task. So Sally has a basket and Ann has a box. Okay. Now Sally has a marble. She puts a marble in her basket. Now imagine the basket has a cloth that covers it. You can't see the contents of the basket. and the box is all closed as well. So Sally puts her marble in the basket. Then Sally goes away and Anne switches the marble and puts it in the box. Okay? So this is sort of the scenario presented to adults and children and everybody. Now the question is, where's the marble? It's in the box, right? So that's what reality is. In reality, that's what the object is. But in Sally's mind, the marble is in the basket. Now you can ask a three-year-old that where will Sally first search for her marble? And it turned out that for a long time the observation was a three-year-old would say the box and a four-year-old would say the basket. So the idea was that, you know, till you're about 3, 4 years old, you can't represent somebody else's mind, right? And therefore you cannot compute what's the content of someone else's mind and use that to predict what that person might do. Yeah? Now it turns out that now we have, and I'm really sorry I can't go through the evidence because it's fabulous, there's evidence by 17 months that they have this capacity of representing someone else's mind and the contents of someone else's mind and using that to predict where the person might search for an object. And yes?
Sorry, I think how is it thinking of someone else's mind? I thought they're shown that she should sit to the other box. They're not shown?
No, they are. They're shown that. So Anne moves it to the box, right?
Okay.
Now you just start off with seeing these two objects.
Right.
Now you ask the question, where will Sally look for the marble?
Correct.
So where's the marble? It's in the box, right? So if you just ask, you know, where should she search, you know that it's in the box. So if you are not taking into consideration what Sally knows, you'll say she should search in the box because I know the marble is in the box. Right? But if I take Sally's perspective, from Sally's point of view, who doesn't know, she thinks that the marble is still in the basket, right?
So Anne learned about heritage.
Sorry, you are. And again, something that I can't go into, but there's now evidence, even at 7 months, that there is something like the capacity for representing the contents of someone else's mind.
What you did say previously, the 3 years old cannot see it out.
Yeah, so it turns out that there are many, many reasons why 3 year olds fail. And the summary is that the task is too hard. So if I imagine that you're a 3 year old and I say, where will Sally look for the marble? You have to figure out, what are you asking me? You have to figure out the language. You're just like starting off learning languages. You know, you're not certain what you're saying. I don't know what you're talking about. Who are you? I'm just going to go with the box. Yes.
Last 23 year old.
Uh-huh.
Is there any statistical study done so that at least a large number of 3-year-olds, some will use the right
hand? Yes. So it's not you're right, there's a distribution. So if you start looking from 3 and 4 and plot the frequency with which, then you'll see that there is some low frequency at 3-year-olds and it grows. But the point is that, in fact, there are various sorts of ways in which you can make life easy for the baby. So one way is that people have done eye tracking studies where instead of asking the question, where will Sally look? Sally walks in, where's the marble? And if you follow the infant's gaze, even a 3-year-old very frequently will first look at the basket. So if you simplify the task through a whole range of things, you find that the age moves up further and further. And now there are tasks that are really simple that use eye tracking techniques that show that 17-month-olds can certainly succeed at this task.
So you're saying the complexity of this particular task is the linguistic complexity?
Amongst other things. We know that linguistic complexity contributes to it, but it's not the only sort of complexity. But it makes a difference, yes.
I just wanted to ask, what about memory and retention of things, age-like increases?
Yeah, no, definitely. So memory is another case where, for example, if you wait for a longer amount of time, you get worse in this task, and it's not just babies, right? You just don't remember things well enough. So you're right, all these things like, you know, how much memory demands there are, how many linguistic demands there are, how many social demands there are, all of these sort of combine together to make the task very hard for a 3-year-old. But if you can make the task simple, then a 17-month-old can succeed. That's sort of the gist of the story.
How long can we the thing is, like, we do some experiments with the rats or stuff like that, you know, the very beginning, if you do
something, they sort of get used to it and they remember, like, okay, when a bell rings, I'm supposed to go and have my food or whatever. But if you just discontinue that, they forget about it. But some of them retain back again, so the moment again you get back to it, they come back to the food. So how do you relate to that? So they come back, you know, the memory flashes back to them, but you know, if you just leave them, there's a...
Okay, so in this particular case, there's not a too large a memory component, right? It's just like a scene in front of you. It's like a little play.
Whatever, like, if I know there is a light that I'm supposed to go there, like every day I see a light, I go.
Yeah, but...
10 days you don't show me a light, so I don't go.
Yeah.
20th day, if you show me, some of them will go back, but some of them will forget about it.
Okay, are you asking in relation to this particular experiment?
No. In general, I'm asking about the processing of ideas that you talk about in behavioral patterns.
About memory.
Yeah.
Okay, so the idea about memory is this, that like I said, you can now show that even neurons have some sort of memory and some sort of retention and some sort of processing. So they remember not just simple... So here's the standing. You can give them little syllables that are either something like boo-ge-ge, le-ma-ma, ho-woo-woo. So always have this pattern A-B-B, right? Now you wait for a while, like 2 minutes, and now you either play to them a new syllable that they've never heard before, like ga-lo-lo, or you play them something like ga-lo-ga, which is not the right pattern. The brain reacts differentially to ga-lo-ga versus ga-lo-lo, saying that there is some memory very early on, and it's of a sort that can also make some abstract generalization. So like ADD, the pattern. Now coming to different sorts of memories, like what you're saying is the relation between associating two things, for example, sound and maybe food or something like that. There's a very rich literature showing that this simple idea that it's simply association between A and B, that idea doesn't explain exactly the sort of things that you were asking, that why is it that sometimes you retain it when this regime goes away, and why do sometimes you forget everything? Now it turns out that the answer is unfortunately a bit complex, but the gist of it is this. If it makes sense for the organism, right, if the organism can sort of propose a theory for what's happening, it will, and if it thinks that this proposition is useful in some way, it will retain that memory for longer. If that memory is not useful, if it's not predictive of the environment in any way, if the organism cannot form a reasonable hypothesis about what's going on, then that memory is either lost or it's stored in a very, essentially in a different format. I don't know if that helps. But the point is that we can do this later, but the answer is complex. Language. So, yeah, I kind of got a bit, let's say, lost when I came to language because I really don't know where to start. And so, here's what I did. I got a little clip from two great guys, Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. And I'm just going to show you this little clip. It's kind of the end of the day, so I think you might be happy to hear a little British comedy. And hopefully this works. So, Fry, I don't know if you know this show, Fry and Laurie. It's Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie. They just sit and chat about things. And they're sitting and chatting about language, and Stephen Fry is saying something about language.
So let's talk instead about flexibility of language, linguistic elasticity, if you like.
Yes, I think I said earlier that our language, English,
as spoken by us,
as we speak it, yes, certainly defines it. We are defined by our language, if you will.
Hello, we're talking about language.
I can illustrate my point. Let me at least try. Here's a question. Well, my question is this. Is our language, English, capable? Is English capable of demagoguery?
Demagoguery?
Demagoguery.
And by demagoguery you mean?
By demagoguery I mean demagoguery.
I thought so.
Highly charged oratory, persuasive, whipping up rhetoric. Listen to me. If we had been British, would we, under similar circumstances, have been moved, charged up, fired up by those inflammatory speeches, or would we simply have laughed? Is English too ironic to sustain Hitlerian styles? Would his language simply have run false in our ears? nuts. We're talking about eggs. Let me start a leveret here. There's language, and there's speech. There's chess, and there's a game of chess. Mark the difference for me. Mark it, please. We've gone to chess. Imagine a piano keyboard. 88 keys. Only 88, and yet, hundreds of new melodies, new tunes, new harmonies are being composed upon hundreds of different keyboards every day in Dorset alone. Our language, Tiger, our language. Hundreds of thousands of available words, trillions of legitimate new ideas, so that I can say the following sentence and be utterly sure that nobody has ever said it before in the history of human communication. Hold the newsreader's nose squarely, waiter, or friendly milk will countermand my trousers. Perfectly ordinary words, but never before put in that precise order. A unique child delivered of a unique mother. Spend all our days saying to each other the same things time after weary time. I love you, don't go in there, get out, you have no right to say that, stop it, why should I, that hurt, help, Marjorie is dead. Surely it's a thought to take out for a green tea on a rainy sunny afternoon. So new language is more than just a means of communication. Oh, of course it is, of course it is, of course it is, of course it is. My mother, my father, my husband, my brother, my sister, my whore, my mistress, my checkout girl. Language is a complimentary, moist, lemon-scented cleansing square. Language is the breath of God. Language is the dew on a fresh apple. It's the soft rain of dust that falls into a shaft of morning light as you pluck from an old bookshelf a half-forgotten book of erotic memoirs. Language is the creak on a stair. It's a spluttering match held to a frosted pane. It's a half-remembered childhood birthday party. It's the warm, wet, trusting touch of a leaking napkin. The hulk of a charred panzer. The underside of a granite boulder. The first downy growth on the upper lip of a Mediterranean. It's cobwebs long since overrun by an old Wellington boot. The night.
For British comedy, this is extremely rich. This is the classical view of language. This is the Chomsky view. The notion that there are symbols, like it says in the piano keyboard, and you use them in some using some rules of generation to create thousands of melodies. And so the idea is that in language, you have a few sort of pieces and some rules of putting them together that you can use to generate, like you say, trillions of new phrases that have never been said before. I think I'm going to just stop there. Questions?
Is there a mic here?
Yes. Mic.
Lovely. One thing you didn't talk about was categorization in information processing. I mean, because that's such an interesting part of information processing. We reduce down the information that we take into the brain, and yet we then can establish a category which has many different facets. I mean, you think of a human face, look at it from the side, from the back, or from the front. They're all different, and yet we establish an identity for that particular person. Now, I mean, there are rules for that, but I wondered whether you had any thoughts about that, because it seems to me it's such an important part of the initial process of actually storing information.
Yes, absolutely. So the question was about categorization. Now, in cognitive science, this is probably, you know, there are many themes I left out, and I think that probably if there was one more theme I should have added, it would have been categorization. It's because of for the following reason, that, you remember how I said that when I look out in front of me, there are these hundreds of things? Now, if I can somehow reduce all of this complexity, then I don't have to represent every single face, for example. Here's what I can do. I can say, oh, a whole bunch of faces. So I have a quick way of categorizing a face very rapidly, and then maybe all I need to store are little differences, right? So just say this face is longer, shorter, wider, broader. The idea is this, that when you find that if you look at across the whole variety of senses, you find that your perception is not, if you want, extremely granular. You chunk together things together and make units out of them. Okay? And your processing is over these units, not over the lower, if you want, the raw sensorium. And here's an example. This is actually a good audience for this. In Hindi, for example, we make a distinction between pat and pat, which for people from especially American or British English should sound exactly identical, right? And the reason is this, because in our language, the two phonemes pa and pa have different meanings for us, and in, when we build our categories, we build two categories in this region of acoustic space where somebody speaking English builds just one single category, right? So the way that we process audition depends on who we are and what kind of categories we have kind of proposed in the first place. So you hear speech differently if you are English speaking versus if you are Hindi speaking. Now here's the twist, and very few people even, even in language are aware of this, that although it is true that if I give you pat versus pat, if you are American, you essentially think that it's the same syllable. If I now give this to you in a non-linguistic context, so I just take out the little pa, pa, and I say these are drops falling in a bucket. It doesn't matter if you don't speak Hindi. You're as good as a Hindi speaker at telling apart pa and pa, if it's in a non-linguistic context. Which means that not only do we categorize in a really cool way, this is a context-dependent way. That in the context of language, we have one category. In the context of audition, general audition, we have two categories. And this is a really fascinating part. So how do you even make these categories in the first place? So maybe I'll deal with a little bit of this in the next lecture. If I don't, we can talk about it. Yes?
Just a comment on what you've just discussed. Of course, it's sorting as well as linguistic and allied to categorization. I always find it fascinating that mathematics often mirrors what we are naturally. So the concept of the equivalence class, which is absolutely basic in set theory, is so close to what we are as people. So it's mathematics is very much as we develop it. And so set theory is, you know, is natural to us. It's interesting that, in the sense that the first thing that you do when you're in cognition is the matter of distinction between this and not this. Yeah? That's the most basic thing. And of course, set theory is based on I'm in a set or I'm not in a set.
Or I'm in set A versus I'm not in set A.
And with regard to this particular conference, for individuals and groups, the perception of relations is much more difficult. So it took much longer in mathematics for us to figure out to also base mathematics only on morphisms, on maps between things, and forgetting what the things themselves are. So it's...
Can you give an example?
So category theory was only developed in 1940, and there it was when we realized that mathematics actually consists of large different parts of mathematics that have different languages, and we want to know what the commonalities are. So we developed a new way of mapping one part of mathematics onto another part, using maps. And so, and now in the 1960s, William Noël figured out that you could have category theory as a foundation for mathematics, as you have set theory. But we developed set theory first, because it's the thing that's most natural to us. But that's just a comment. I wanted to ask you about, when you now gave, what is star, was it Mike? The three levels that you gave?
Mars.
If you didn't tell me that was the brain, and you just gave those three levels, I would have said it's a universal Turing machine. Okay, so it means that what you've described to us is a computational theory of mind, which is only one of the theories, and I wondered what you had to say about, for instance, Maturana Varela, so that you know, version of cognition.
No, so like I said, that the computational theory of mind is one theory, and you know, the notion is that, you know, if you can find evidence that there are things, for example, the Hardy problem, right? If you can find a problem that the Turing machine is, in a sense, doesn't have a solution, but the mind finds a solution, then it's clear that the computational theory of mind doesn't work in that sense. I just don't know, you know, the other point about this is that, just like you said, there are isomorphisms. during that theory. And I'm not aware of theories that have been shown, or evidence that shows that there is something like some version of the Hartree problem that the mind can solve. Right? If you could, then you could say that there might be another theory that might not be isomorphic with the computational theory. I just don't know if there is some such thing. I'm not aware of the particular theory you refer to. I'm not aware of this kind.
I'm also not an expert. I just know about this theory and I thought that you might have an opinion.
No, sorry.
I don't want to preempt your next talk, but I would like to hear something about the analogies that you like between computers and our brain.
Oh, no. So, you know, the reason why I put the meat grinder up there and not a PC was because I wanted to speak in generic terms. Doesn't even care about the, about particular implementations of any sort at all. You essentially you make up your own representations. You know, a phoneme is something you make up. It has very good explanatory value. You can sort of try to look for it in the auditory signal, but it's not even clear that you can do that every single time, right? So it remains still in the mind. I don't have a good, if you want, notion of computation beyond the simple notion that you need a certain representation. And you have to find certain algorithms that can put them together. That's the, I would say the extent I would be willing to push that.
This is related, actually. So you went, I really enjoyed that, by the way. But you went rather quickly at the beginning over the notion of representation and about standing for something. And I know that it's something that philosophers worry about a great deal. So assuming that the idea of the iPod matches the iPod in some way, that there's some sort of correlation between them. In virtue of what is the idea about the iPod, but the iPod's not about the idea, where do you get that asymmetry from?
Well, in a very crude sense,
Could you just summarize the question briefly?
Yes. So the question is this, is there an asymmetry between the representation of the iPod in your mind and the iPod, such that one stands for the other, but the other doesn't stand for the one. Is that roughly right?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's really the, imagine if you were building an expert system on a computer, which reasoned about iPads, it reasoned about all kinds of electronic goods, right? In your system, you would have to build something, a representation, that would stand for the iPad out there. Right? So in a sense, the internal representation is, it comes after the object itself. So I think that is the asymmetry, that you know there's no a priori nature to the representation in your mind except through a computation.
To ask you actually, would it also be part of the asymmetry that you have a loss of information going from the object itself through its representation?
I believe the, well, so some philosophers make this into a very mysterious issue. I think there's something irreducible about intentionality.
Yes.
There's something almost magical. Something can be about something only if it's got this special property of consciousness or mentality or something. More empirically minded philosophers, I think, try to say that there needs to be a failure condition. So my idea is about the iPod, if it's possible that I'm wrong about the iPod in some sense, whereas there's no sense in which the iPod could ever be wrong about my idea.
Of your idea. Okay, so let me say one more word about the whole notion of concepts, because you're right, it is an extremely hairy philosophical issue, and I'm not at all an expert on that. It really hurts my mind to think about it. But here's the sort of idea that you have, is that how does it come to be that there is something in your mind that has this relation to something out in the world? And now this particular problem is, I don't know of a good solution to this. And in fact, everywhere that people have the bitter fights is about how exactly does something in my mind come to be about something out there in the world? Okay? And what Ellen is asking, that in that situation, why is it not that that thing out in the world also has a reciprocal connection to something that's in my mind? I don't want to go there. And that's really hard. And
I'm going to show that.
This has to do with the language. Every word can have different meaning depending on the context.
Yes.
So how does the brain process it?
If you use a computer, many times it makes errors. For example, idioms or phrases.
Yes.
The spirit is willing, the flesh is weak. This was translated into Russian by a computer, saying that the wine is good, but the meat is what?
Yeah.
How does the brain process the information?
Again, this is a great question. There is no answer to this, but let me first say what the question is and what people think about it. The question is this, that why is it that words mean different things in different contexts? Okay? So the example that Mike gave was that if I say the spirit is willing. The spirit is willing and the flesh is weak, it gets translated, flesh is weak gets translated as the meat is not good. Okay, because approximately is the right sense. So how do we have, I mean, this is one example, here's another example that okay, let me just step back a little. When we speak, the words that we use, the meaning is severely underdetermined by what we are saying. A specific case is what was just being referred to, the fact that a word can mean different things under different circumstances. But let me give you another example. Okay? I say, I have two boys. What does that mean to you? It means that I have two boys and that's it. But if I had three boys, my statement is still logically true, right? I have three children, they're all boys, and I say, I have two boys. What I said was true, I have two boys. But that's not what you think when I say, I have two boys. You think I have two and only two boys, right? So in every case, even where cases where you think are entirely obvious, the meaning is not transparent and depends on the context. In this particular case, it turns out that people have theorized that you have something like pragmatic rules. So you, it's sort of a pragmatic convention that if I say two, I'm sort of being as informative as possible. If I had three, I would have said three, and I'm not trying to fool you in any way, right? So there are various sort of conventions that we think that we use in trying to figure out the meanings of words, and in general, or the meaning of sentences, and in general, the notion is of context dependence. The question though, the hard question is, how do you compute context dependence? In cognition, this has been expanded that anytime I encounter a concept, how do I understand what that concept is about in that particular situation, right? So for example, if we were talking about my grandmother for the last half an hour, and then you walk into the conversation and I say that, oh, you know, and she was so tall. Now if you had just walked into the conversation, she was so tall, perfectly natural English sentence, has no meaning for you beyond sort of what the words tell you, but the person who had been listening to you for the last half an hour and bored to death knows what you're talking about, right? So sort of the background knowledge, what you're thinking about, what experiences you've had in your past, all of them seem to play a role in determining the meaning of sentences and even just single words. But how this is done is a complete mystery. So I don't know the answer to your precise question.
Gopal? Yes, I'm just a technical point that the reduction in the number of bits that you mentioned, is it only meant for visual perception or for olfactory or tactile or auditory? And
so the specific numbers I gave are from a paper where they...
Yeah, like the general reduction you mentioned, like what is the magnitude and how to almost what...
Yeah, I have not actually seen the numbers, so I don't know if the reduction is that great in attention. So when you're attending to a certain modality, in general, it's true that it's much smaller, but I don't know if the numbers are comparatively low.
Okay, but does that pattern recur in all other senses?
In audition, for sure. Olfaction, I don't
know.
In
olfaction.
Yeah, is it?
Yeah, because there are different kinds of, I mean, some number is 100 or something.
Right.
Types of speech we can smell or something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and how many can you attend to at one point?
That is also, I think, different. I mean, it's variable, it's not comparable.
Well, I mean, so if there are just 100 receptors, then even if you can smell one, the order of magnitude change is much smaller than from 10 to the 9 to 40. So,
I mean,
in that sense, you know that...
Would these points matter in case of what you're talking about, the properties of cognition, individually? I mean, whether this reduction is, in a way, responsible or very closely related to that?
So, would it matter to the properties of cognition?
Yes. Olfactory cognition versus visual versus auditory and
associative ones.
because you always bring this sound, the light, or visual.
Okay. So I bring up sound and light just because they're the most intensively studied. But I think the general question is really interesting, that does it change the nature of cognition? So for example, take perception or take memory. Does the nature of memory change for different senses? Is essentially what you're asking, right? Do different senses have different bottlenecks, information bottlenecks? And therefore, does that impact how various properties of cognition change? And I think the answer should be yes. But I'm not certain. Now, here's what I can tell you. Like, suppose you had something like, suppose you had an artificial reduction in your sensory information, right? So for example, if I cover one eye, you're getting essentially half the amount of information than you're getting with two eyes, right? Now, how much of your visual attention do you think really changes? Just phenomenologically speaking, you know, if I close one eye,
yeah.
Many cues like depth perception, which are thought to use entirely stereo cues, turn out not to be true. We do have depth perception even with a single eye. So there seem to be some redundant mechanisms, and eventually what I'm going to say as a sort of fail-safe is that this is an empirical question. And I don't know the direct answer. You would suspect there are differences.
Well, for example, brings such great memories, actually. You know, I mean, you can imagine all kind of things by just spelling something.
So let me just give you one piece of information that may or may not help. Now, different species live in different habitats, and of course they have different sorts of brains. Now, what you can do is you can go and look at the extent of the brain occupied by the primary visual areas of touch, vision, and audition. And this is some really beautiful work from John Kass and Leah Krubitzer. They had three animals with roughly the same brain size, and they simply map how much of the brain is occupied by each of these three cortical areas. You find that in a visual fox, there's a large V1, the primary visual cortex, and small areas for haptic sensation and audition. In a similar sized animal, a bat, the auditory area is massive, the visual area is not too big, and the somatosensory area is fairly small. And finally, in a rodent species that uses a lot of its whiskers and paws for digging around the ground, the somatosensory area is massive and the other areas are much smaller. Now, it's not clear. The other part of the question is, how are the senses separate? So are the eyes bringing in much less information? In fact, the idea is that if your eye brings in less information, then your visual cortex will develop to be much smaller through phylogeny. But maybe also through ontogeny. So you find that if you delete one of the eyes, you find that the area occupied by the other eye comes and infiltrates the area that had been taken over by the now defunct eye. So it seems that there is some variation, and that the input drives at least different brain areas, and therefore you suspect that they might have an effect on cognition. But I can't say a general theme that I can.
If you can't speak, so if you do these experiments with infants who are born dumb, for instance, what kind of a pattern of cognition in those experiments, how do they perform? Is there a difference since language is at the basis of your...
Yeah, so this is interesting. So remember I said that you can now move this experiment down to 17-month-olds, so they don't even have to speak anymore. So the experiments with the very young babies rely on just the baby interpreting a scene in front of them, and then the pattern of looking, just the way the baby looks at the various objects, tells you what the baby does.
No, I mean older infants who can speak versus those who can't speak.
So here's the thing. Since you know that you don't need language to succeed in the task, if you do find some sort of failures or discrepancies, those you might ascribe to task-related difficulties rather than theory of mind difficulties. Does that make sense? So suppose you do find, I don't know if this experiment has been done, but suppose you find that kids who are born dumb when they reach 4 years of age, then they don't succeed with the task as well as comparable kids who can speak. If it turns out that at 17 months, it doesn't matter if you're dumb or not, because you're not relying on your speech apparatus at all, if you suspect that everyone's the same, and then you would say that the sort of the difficulty that the kids who cannot speak have might be because of task related and not because of the development of the theory of mind itself.
So you're saying if the experiment was done, the interpretation would be different?
Yes, but I don't think it's been done.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. So, yeah.
coming back to the context of individuals versus group. For example, we are listening to you as a group. Collectively, we are performing the same behavior. At the same time, each of us doing different behaviors. Okay, our degrees of paying attention to you, retention capacity of memories, and whatever you have said, that is perception, etc., all are different. Fine. But consider it as a military academy. You are doing martial arts. Single command, one language. Okay, all individuals
are performing the same behavior collectively. As a group, as well as individually, they are performing the same activity at the time. So my question is, when, suppose all the properties or factors you have already said us about this memory and other things, this language, if all works together synchronizingly, then the activity will be the same?
You mean?
Or the behavior will be the same? Because we study behavior among animals. For example, individually as well as in a group. So when the behavior will be same for an individual as well as for the group, when all the properties will act harmony.
Yeah, I mean, wow, that's a hard question. I'll tell you why it's a hard question. Because I'm not really... So, okay, let me start with saying what does it mean?
Just consider the other example as well as... Because in the military academy, the language is very easy, and audition or paying attention is also same.
So, let me make a distinction. Okay, so in the case of a military academy, that is something that you have learned to do in a certain way, right, all together. Okay, so you're asking the question that right now, if for somehow magically all of our cognitive properties of perception, memory, attention, everything was exactly the same, would everybody sort of understand things in exactly the same way? This is a really hard question. The reason is because we know now that even at the individual level, there are big differences in cognition from one person to the next. And wow, I mean, so in your thought experiment, the one thing that I would say to add to that would be the history. And given the history that each individual comes to the table with, your memory banks, even if at the moment your memory is all similar, the fact that all of you come from different historical background has to change your cognitive system in some way that makes it impossible for everything to be identical. You know, so let me give you an example. One of you was asking about the fact that, I think you were asking in Paul's talk, that do you have a single bacterium when you do the plating, right? Now, if you came from a bacteriology department or microbiology department, you know, you have all that experience, and it never even occurs to you that this point is ambiguous in your talk. So for Paul, sorry, please, he's not here. Yeah. So, you know, for Paul, if I can say, it probably never occurred to you to even explain that the notion that a single colony is thought to be clonal, derived from a single cell. But this is not obvious, right? So your memory, all your background, right? When you bring that to the table, people think about the same things in a different way. In fact, this is of great importance for teaching, because when you go out to teach to a whole bunch of people, they have exactly this problem. You say a word like I say a word like, I don't know, constant, and maybe somebody doesn't know what the word constant means, or they have a completely different interpretation. I say colony, they don't know what a colony really entails, right? So this is something that I don't think can be made exactly the same because of historical reasons.
And in case of the military, the consequences would also be important. Somebody, if he doesn't walk properly.
Then we have a last question from Tariq.
You were putting different cognitive units like vision, memory, like independent units. I would like to hear your thoughts about significance between crosstalk or coordination between different, you know, cognitive units. Like, my question is basically a follow-up to what Gopal just asked. You know, you have smell and then a memory. Or like, I pass through a road and that vision gets stored in my memory. So how significant is that? How do you see that does not then put these five units independently there? There is a great coordination among all these things. That's why human brain or cognition is, I think we can't put it in like a computer.
No, I entirely agree, 100%. And I'm sorry if that was your question, I didn't get it. But absolutely, there are crosstalks and interactions in everything. Now, let me give you the example from language, because that's what I'm most comfortable with. When you think about language, how do you learn a word? Well, is there a memory component? Yes, you have to store whatever it is that you've heard. Is there an attentional component? Yes. Things that you attend to, we know, are better memorized Is there a perceptual component?
Yes.
You know, when you listen to a word, your perceptual system, the notion of categorization and so forth, come into play. So of course, everything is interrelated, but for the sake of simplicity, you know, kind of chop things up, like in all of science, for the sake of simplicity, chop things up and then hopefully at some time put it together. So the next time I'll talk about more putting together, how you have interactions between your social senses and the notion that you want to learn something.